Something is different this week. Things are a bit different. Jeff is the engineer this week. We're recording at his end for special reasons. We're trying to set this up. Ubercaster is making it possible. The fact that we can bundle the thing up, I just ship it over there with all the boom and everything else, and bam, we can do it. Technology is amazing. Today is May 26th, 2007, and this is the Apple Weekly Report, a Mac Observer podcast. I'm Ricky Spiro.
And I'm Jeff Gamet. You, to get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/roundup.
What a stupid week. I think I saw more iPhone commentary and crazy talk, more than I ever had any right to expect. And we're still 2 weeks away from WWDC. People are losing their frickin' minds over this. We're not having it on this show this week. We're going to have a sober discussion about internet radio and copyright payments. Internet radio is in danger. Duck! Also, I'm going to tell you about an iPod Shuffle case that doubles as a bottle opener. It's real, and it's here. Jeff, hit the news.
Okay. A couple of months ago, we reported that a ruling to change how royalties are collected from independent internet radio stations had the potential to actually drive many of the sites out of business. The sequence of events involves the Copyright Royalty Board, or CRB, which is a U.S. government agency tasked with overseeing the royalty process, and Sound Exchange, which is the arm of the Recording Industry Association of America, is responsible for the music royalty collection, and internet radio stations, which stream ad or subscription-supported music over the internet.
Now, the Copyright Protection Board decided to change the way that most small webcast stations are charged from a percentage of revenue to a pay-per-song and per-listener model. The new royalty rates were scheduled to go into effect around this time, but for the smallest stations, the change would have increased royalty payments to as much as 10 times what they're currently paying. In some cases, the new rates amount to more than a station's annual income.
And the new per-play fee structure was proposed to the CRB by Sound Exchange and the royalties branch of the RIAA. Now, the conventional wisdom is that the pricing structure favors large internet radio firms who can either make up the cost and volume of listeners and ad sales, or who can afford to negotiate more favorable royalty pricing.
So this week, we reported on how things stand today. The rate hikes have been put off to July, and Sound Exchange has offered a conditional settlement to the stations in hopes of getting the new payment plan back on track. Station owners aren't pleased with the offer, but do see it as a starting point for negotiations. Thanks to this outcry over the CPB's plans, bills to change the rate ruling found their way into both houses of the United States Congress. Broadcasters have also banded together to take their battle into the courtroom. The proposal from Sound Exchange is, in effect, a $1.2 million U.S. per year extension of the previous deal until 2010. The issue is that if a broadcaster's revenue breaks through $1.2 million per year, if it breaks through that ceiling, it'll be retroactively liable for the CPB's new pay-per-performance scheme.
Now, the rhetoric from Sound Exchange is that this plan gives small internet radio stations, which are the ones hit hardest by the new rules, more time to develop into big radio stations that can support the higher pricing scheme. The rhetoric from the radio stations is that the compromise only offers a disincentive for small stations to break through the $1.2 million cap. As an attorney for the web broadcaster says, who will invest in an entity with an absolute cap on their financial growth? Sound Exchange's overarching contention is that internet radio stations are paying below market rates for the music they play. Under the current agreement, the stations pay between 10 and 12% of their annual income, and it is currently unclear whether the July deadline will hold firm, and it's uncertain what impact the legal and legislative battles will have.
also in this week's news, change of subject. Well, we filled day after day after day with articles about the iPhone, or more precisely, about the hype building around the iPhone. There were around a dozen articles directly related to iPhone speculation, analysis, commentary, but the winner of the week had to be a survey of cell phone users who already think that the combination iPod and smartphone is better than what they're using today. And there are only about 20 people outside of Apple and Singular who have ever touched the damn thing. The survey was conducted by Strategy Analytics, whose president, Harvey Cohen, said an overwhelming 90% of respondents gave the iPhone higher marks than their own handset, and over 40% of respondents rated the iPhone much better across key functional categories, including music player, web browsing, voicemail, and phone call management. Talk about the grass is greener on the other side. Despite the overwhelming positive response, survey participants still thought that the iPhone's $499 US or $599 price points could be a barrier to wide acceptance. So that is the context of machine fodder for this week. And let's talk now about internet radio. This is actually, we haven't dealt with this on the show yet. And it's kind of a weird scenario. There's a lot of talk, particularly, of course, from the folks who are very internet savvy and who are patronizing places like the Mac Observer, that this is about the end of internet radio. So the first question is, would this new pricing structure, if it went into effect as it was originally envisioned, would it kill internet radio?
You know, I think for the United States, the answer would be mostly yes. How's that for just talking around everything? Okay, the deal is that this ruling affects radio stations or internet radio stations inside the United States, not stations from outside the country. And larger stations, you know, like the really big names, they can probably absorb the cost in other parts of their business. But the small size and the mid-size stations most likely would be priced right out of business, especially because they would be responsible for royalty payments retroactively to the beginning of last year. So we're talking about paying 125% probably of all of last year's income, not just what they made, but their actual gross income. And there's a lot of stations that would shut down before that happens so that they're out of business and not part of the game anymore.
Now, one thing that I imagine happening here is that people in these businesses would say, you know what, we just can't. Right now, they pay as a percentage of income. So their inclination is to just play as much music as possible and earn as much money as possible, and then they have to give some flat percentage of that away. If this went into effect, I can imagine that talk radio, internet radio, would get a huge boost, and that the stations that were on the edge that might die would just start playing less music.
Yeah, I could see where that would happen too. However, a lot of what's going on with internet radio right now really is about the music. So we'd be losing a huge section of that whole medium. And unfortunately, we'd also end up losing a lot of music that otherwise wouldn't get any type of airplay. So, yeah, we probably would see some more talk radio type things crop up, but I don't think it would balance out the number of stations that would drop off the music playing end of the spectrum.
All right. Now, one of the other things I'm curious about here, who listens to internet radio? I mean, I'll be honest, I never listened to it. I know that there are internet radio stations that you can get through iTunes. I know that there are others that you can get online. I never listened to it. I've seen some users, some readers at TMO talk about how they are consumers of internet radio. Do you listen to internet radio? Do you know a lot of people that do?
Actually, yes. I listen to internet radio almost every day. It's really nice when I'm sitting here going through the news, writing articles, to have interesting music that has no lyrics playing in the background. So I go out and search out different internet radio stations that play, you know, maybe ambient music or classical or electronica. I have a wide range of internet radio stations that I'll listen to. And I've picked each one of them simply because they play music that I don't have and that I otherwise wouldn't have heard. So for me, it's a really cool thing to use. And yeah, I do know a lot of people that are listening to internet radio and are really concerned about what's going to happen with all of this. So, but I might be in a minority. I don't know.
Well, it is. I mean, it's interesting to hear from people, and it's always been interesting for me to read comments from people that do listen. My sense was always that it was a fairly niche market, but clearly it's a market that people, and you're clearly in this category, that the people that listen to it like it. They get something really valuable out of it.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, what it comes down to is that they can have, in essence, what satellite radio is, meaning this digital, transportable music or just sound medium, and it can go wherever they have an internet connection. And so it makes it real easy for people to pick out a group of internet-based stations they really like and take them with them wherever they go.
Yeah, fair enough. And it makes sense as people begin to move forward with the iPhone. I can imagine, you know, Apple has always strayed away from bundling or partnering with the satellite radio stations with the iPod. But what one can imagine for an internet-enabled device like the iPhone, maybe people really want to listen to internet radio on their iPod.
You know, that's really clever. I like that idea.
Anyway, let's talk a little bit about business here. The record industry, of course, came up with this change. They're backing this change in pricing. Why?
Well, the RIAA feels that internet radio stations are not paying a fair price for the music that they're streaming. And what they want to do is bring the rates that these internet stations are paying in line with what they feel is a fair market value. Now, in their defense, that totally makes sense. You don't want to sell a product for below market value. You're not going to make any money. On the other hand, they're taking it to what appears to be an extreme, and it's actually going to price everyone out of business, and they won't be able to make any money on this. So, you know, they're kind of in a...
That, to me, is the most astonishing thing about this, that they'd have a product, right, internet radio, that currently is a revenue stream. If this was really going to execute internet radio, it seems hard to believe that they would make this change and say, hey, we're going to set the prices to market value and, in the process, destroy this revenue stream.
Yeah, that seems like a pretty myopic way to go about this. Now, what they're saying is that that's not at all what will happen, and that the stations ought to be able to afford to pay these rates. Their feeling is that most of the stations are actually going to be okay with this. Now, they have backpedaled a little bit because it's actually gotten to the point where we have bills in the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate to change the Copyright Royalty Board ruling. And so now Sound Exchange has gone around the CRB and is saying, okay, we get it. You don't think that your businesses are growing fast enough to be able to support the new rates. Therefore, what we'll do is kind of grandfather the old agreement forward through 2010, which will give you time to grow your business and put the other things in place, the infrastructure that you need, to be able to actually track all of the songs and pay appropriately. Which, if they're being totally fair and totally honest about it, great, that's a nice thing to do, because now you're giving the stations time to catch up and grow their business to the point where they can afford to pay the rates.
So, but I still have a hard time believing that. I mean, there is certainly, right, I mean, there's merit certainly in the argument that it's hard, it does weird things to a business when you say, look, you can earn up to $1.2 million. But if you earn a penny more than that, all of a sudden you need to pay for 3 years worth of higher prices of music. First of all, that is going to do weird things to a business.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
The other part of it is the sense that there's, it's possible that internet radio really is just a niche way of listening to music, and that it is just a random additional way that, that a small number of people are going to continue to listen to stuff, and that for the time being, maybe you just earn the little bit of money you can and see if it develops, rather than hold this guillotine over the head of the industry and wait for just the right time to let it drop so you can make as much money as possible. It seems a little awkward.
Yeah, it does. And without being totally inside the middle of all this, being in the back rooms where deals were being struck, it's hard to know what really has been going on. But what it looks like to me is that the RIAA, through Sound Exchange, said, okay, we are not making enough money. This is a revenue stream that we think we can exploit. And when I say exploit, I don't mean in the bad way, but in the sense that it's something they can take advantage of. And so they said, all right, what can we do to better control the revenue stream from this sector of the industry? And someone went, how about if we make them pay per song instead of the 10 or 12% of their gross income that they're doing right now? And someone else went, sweet, let's do it. And then the ball rolled forward, and eventually we ended up where we are. And then on the other end, you have the radio stations going, dude, it's a hardship to pay you 10 or 12% of everything we bring in already. And now you want to bump this up to the point where we can't even pay anything else. What the hell? And
the other thing that's particularly weird about this that just occurs to me, if they really want to see these businesses grow and grow to be very large, one imagines that eventually, if the businesses get big enough, 10 or 12% of what they're earning is a lot of money.
Yes.
So one might think if they're really on the side of watching these businesses grow, grabbing 10 or 12% of that number would be a better thing in the long run than having them pay for song. There are only so many hours in the day. You can only play so many songs every year. So why not just keep taking a cut of revenue?
That makes sense to me. So now, another thing that I had thought about is that possibly the RIAA is using internet radio as a testing ground, because you have satellite radio, which is already paying their royalty rate, which is different from what internet radio has been paying. And then you have terrestrial radio, which really doesn't do this at all. They have a completely different setup for the way they handle their payments. And what I think that this may have been, just in one of my speculations, is a testing ground to see how this plays out with internet radio. Maybe they consider it the expendable medium, and then if they can get what they want, then they take it over to satellite radio. And I think their sights are really on terrestrial radio, where if they change the way the royalty payments work there, that could be a huge cash cow, but it could also potentially put terrestrial stations out of business as well.
All right, so a whole bunch of different possible things going on here. We don't know what's happening. We're just confused by it all. If you know what's going on, send us an email, roundup@macobserver.com. Let's talk about one other thing before we move out of the context machine. iPhone.
iPhone?
Are people sane?
The quick answer, no. The slightly longer answer, Apple, they must be doing cartwheels right now, because you can't buy publicity like that. I mean, the whole thing with having a study where you check, where you ask people, does the iPhone perform this function better than the phone you have right now? Meaning the phone that's in their hand, as opposed to the iPhone, which is in no one's hand. And they're going, oh yeah, the iPhone does that a lot better. How does that happen?
You just There are no words, are there? You just got to say, how do you do that?
Yeah, when I first heard about that, I actually sat back in my chair and I went, holy crap. And then went back and looked at the study information again and went, no, this is really what they're saying.
This really actually happened.
Yeah, and so what I came out of that with, from a positive standpoint, not the world has gone insane over the iPhone, but what I came out of it with was people are saying that what they currently have, as far as a cell phone, smartphone, whatever, it's crap, and they don't like it. The interface sucks. The way the product works sucks. And they're saying, please, Apple, give us a product that's better than what we already have. That's where I think people's minds probably were when they were looking at the videos and flashcards or whatever they were being shown for iPhone features.
Yeah, there's one other thing that occurs to me now that we're talking about this. So Strategy Analytics, I don't know anything about this firm. I don't know anything about the methodology of the study, but one can imagine one possible bias in how these numbers got developed. If they were asking people, does your phone do this better or worse than the iPhone? And I have no freaking idea was not an acceptable answer, and they were only taking yes or no as an answer, that would create a bias. I can imagine a lot of people would say, well, it looks like it might do that stuff better than my phone.
Sure.
That's a possibility.
Yeah, and we weren't sitting in the room, and actually, had we been, the answers might have been different because the questions probably would have been different as well. So when we start running our own studies, boy, you can bet the results are going to be just rock solid, totally spot on, usable.
That's right, because when we're kings of the world, man,
that's right. Gonna be...
And when we're kings of the world, you'll still be able to send us email, roundup@macobserver.com. That's it for the context machine. Let's do some other stuff.
Hey, you know what? I really like that. That was cool bluesy sound. But enough of that. Okay, let's do a product roundup. Today we have two things we're going to be talking about. I'm going to be talking about a cool little computer backpack that I've come across, and Ricky's going to be talking about the Bevy. And how did I just make that sound come out?
Yeah, talking about the Bevy and the Fuse. Jeff, why don't I know nothing about the Fuse. I know it's a backpack.
Okay.
Why don't you start off?
All right, so the Fuse, it's a backpack, computer backpack from a company called Spire, and they sent one to me a little while ago to review, and I haven't run a review yet on Mac Observer because I'm still running some tests. But just to give you a preview, I'm really liking this bag. It has a lot of neat features. It's big enough to hold a 17-inch PowerBook, if you're lucky enough to have one, or MacBook Pro as well. It has a removable padded sleeve that the laptop sits in, and it also includes a separate shoulder strap. So if you need to drop off your bag somewhere but take the computer with you, you can pull the padded compartment out, hook on a shoulder strap, and off you go. It has like three big pockets, organizer pockets in it, and it even has a separate iPod pocket with a little opening so you can get your headphones out and listen to your iPod while it's on your backpack. You can also stash away the straps so that it works as a carry-on bag. It's built really well. It has a lot of great features. So far I'm pleased with it. There's only a couple minor things that I don't like, and they're the same things I don't like about a lot of bags, which is when you have a seam where two pieces of fabric come together and it's left with just the raw edges, so that can fray over time. There's some seams like that in this bag. And honestly, that's something that I ding almost every bag maker on.
Yeah, so How big is this thing? Is it like you said? It works as a carry-on. Is it big enough to put in clothes for like an overnight stay or a weekend trip, or is it just big enough as a briefcase? How big is it?
You know, it would be easier to use more as a briefcase size bag. Although, if you're a really light traveler, sure, you could probably throw in something to get you by overnight. But I wouldn't want to go much bigger than, or put much more in it than that.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't have like an expansion thing in it so you can make it bigger?
No, but it does have compression straps so you can make it smaller.
Ah, which is a nice thing to have.
Which is a very nice thing, because that can also help you keep from having gear settled to the bottom of the bag.
Yeah. Cool. Well, the thing I was going to talk about, the Bevy, is made by a company called Mophie, M-O-P-H-I-E. Of course, all this stuff is in the show notes. And Mophie is a company up in Burlington, Vermont. This product was developed. They had someone actually scribble out an idea for an iPod shuffle case that is an iPod shuffle case, a key ring, has a thing where you can wrap your headphones around it, and is also a bottle opener.
What kind of bottle? Please tell me beer.
Beer.
Sweet.
It is the most ridiculous product I think I've ever seen in my life. And I'm talking about them on the show because how can you not talk about something that is all of these random things together? The idea of an iPod shuffle case always seemed intrinsically silly to me because the thing is its own case, right? It has a clip.
Right.
The one thing about this, if there was one place I was going to make an iPod case, it would probably be in a key ring, which I never had thought of before, because your keys are something you never forget. And the one thing I hear people say about the iPod shuffle is that would be so easy to lose.
Yeah, so, I could see that. Yeah.
And there have been times, you know, I'll go to work, I'll have the iPod shuffle on my pocket or on my back pocket or, you know, on my belt or something. And when I get to work, I take off my headphones and put them away. But then I'll leave because I don't want to lose the shuffle or throw it in the bottom of a bag. I just leave it on my pocket. And there have been times when, you know, it's fallen off my pocket and onto the floor and I easily could have lost it. So there it's kind of useful, you know, when I'm not using it, I stick it on the keychain. The bottle opener, you have to remove the iPod shuffle to use the bottle opener.
Well, that makes sense, because you don't want your shuffle getting wet.
Yeah, which is probably something they thought of. It is pretty easy to pop the thing out and use it. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's just kind of a silly product. And honestly, the greatest impact of this product is not its functionality. It does exactly what it says and nothing more. The thing to wrap around the headphones is, I don't find it terribly useful, but it's there and doesn't take up extra space. And the thing that I am left with, the biggest impression I'm left with, is actually from all of their marketing material. You have to understand, I saw this thing show up on, I think we ran an article that said, hey, this thing just got released. And I looked at it and I said, what? I have to see that. So I sent him a note and said, let me take a look at it. And so they ship, it's an iPod shuffle case, right? It's a key ring. So the product itself takes up about a cubic inch, right?
Right.
It came in a box that was about a cubic foot.
So you don't lose it. Duh.
With a huge amount of paper padding, with like 5 or 8 or 10 pages of promotional material, some of which had, you know, comments from other reviewers. This is common when you get press material. And among those things were comments from reviewers that were kind of vaguely neutral on the product, or at least had ways of being read that were slightly negative. I've never seen that come from a PR agency before. They had they had the product itself, obviously. They had a notepad with Mophie on it. They had, which is kind of cute, because they have this whole thing about the Illuminator process and how this was a sort of organically consumer-driven product. That's kind of cute. A T-shirt, which again, often companies do that. They'll send you T-shirts when they send you stuff for review. And they sent a bottle of beer. Sarnak.
Nice.
But it was empty.
Oh.
And the cap had already been removed. So I couldn't even test the bottle opener with the thing they sent me. It was like a kind of a psychological reminder. You could have opened this bottle with this thing had it been covered with beer in it.
I love it.
It was one of the most bizarre experiences. This huge freaking box on my doorstep. Why is this here? So cubic foot to ship a whole bunch of things. And that's the thing. How can you not when the product is a cubic inch and they send you all this stuff? Ultimately, there's nothing to say about the product. It's a perfectly nice iPod shuffle case. Clever idea. Go check it out. It's worth the $15 to buy it, I think. But all I can actually talk about is the press material.
So maybe they should start selling the press material.
I guess so.
I'm just so really disappointed they sent you an empty beer bottle. That's just not right.
We had so much fun drinking this bottle.
And packing all these things into this one cubic foot box for you. Yes.
It was nice. I liked it.
You know, even though the Fuse is such a cool bag to talk about, I had more fun listening about the bevy.
$15 and to 90% of shuffle owners, probably not worth the time, but I had to talk about it.
Well, there you go. Okay. Well, apparently I can't make the punch board work anymore. So we'll just have to move on. And that's the news. Thanks for listening to Apple Weekly Report.
Our content, of course, is written by the staff of the Mac Observer. The bandwidth is by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom for TMO. Congrats to Jeff. His first excursion as a recording engineer was today. And aside from that little blip, did a bang-up job. Well done, sir.
Why, thank you so much. And it when the sound clip didn't play, I just sat here and looked at my Mac in disbelief. And I kept thinking, I'm clicking the button. I'm clicking the button. Why is there no sound? Oh, well.
Well, one day there's a joke in there somewhere. I couldn't come up with it fast enough.
Yeah, well, we'll put it on another show. So, and I guess on that note, stay subscribed.
Until next week, folks, we'll see you online. He got it!
That one worked.